Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. It was just after sunrise on April 12th of 1981 when 14-year-old Sheila Sharp walked the short distance home to Cabin 28 in the tiny Sierra Nevada community of Keddie, California. She opened the door to find an unimaginable horror inside. In a small living room, Sheila's 15-year-old brother John and his friend, 17-year-old Dana Wingate, lay on the blood-soaked carpet, bound with cords and medical tape, and brutally beaten. Nearby, under a yellow blanket, was the lifeless body of Sheila's mother, 36-year-old Glenna Sue Sharp. The teen's screams pierced the Sunday morning silence as she ran from the cabin, hysterically alerting the neighbors that something terrible had happened. The Seabolt family, who lived just 15 feet away in Cabin 27, raced back to Cabin 28 with Sheila, and they were confronted with a gruesome scene almost beyond comprehension. Shockingly, they discovered that three young boys, Sheila's two younger brothers, 5-year-old Greg and 10-year-old Rick, along with their 12-year-old friend Justin Smart, had survived the night unscathed in an adjacent bedroom. The boys were terrified, but physically unharmed. The Seabolts carefully helped the children climb out a back bedroom window to shield them from the bloodbath, while another neighbor ran to the resort lodge to call 911. At 8:05 a.m., the Plumas County Sheriff's Office received the urgent call reporting a possible triple homicide at Cabin 28 of the Keddie Resort. What authorities encountered inside the Sharps' humble cabin that morning would haunt the community for decades to come. One investigator said it was the most vicious, horrible crime ever in this county, a nightmare that shattered the peace of this former railroad resort town. In the hours, days, and years that followed, the question that has plagued investigators and family alike remains: who could have committed such a ruthless crime, and why? This is the unsolved mystery of the Keddie Cabin murders. Glenna Sue Sharp was determined to rebuild her life when she arrived in rural Plumas County in 1979. A Navy wife and mother of five, Sue had finally left her abusive husband, James Sharp, and packed up her children to find a safe haven on the West Coast. After a cross-country journey from the East Coast, where the family had lived in Connecticut and North Carolina, she landed in the tiny town of Quincy, California, where her brother Don was living. At first, the Sharps squeezed into a rundown trailer in Quincy's Claremont Trailer Park, but by the fall of 1980, Sue was able to rent a slightly larger home, Cabin 28, at the Keddie Resort, just 6 miles up the road in the mountains. Keddie was a fading summer vacation village turned affordable residential community nestled in the woods. In its heyday, Keddie boasted a lodge with a bar and restaurant, a general store, and a cluster of rustic cabins that housed railroad workers and young families. By 1980, the resort had fallen on hard times. Management was poor, industry in the area was starting to dry up, and many cabins sat vacant or in disrepair. Still, for Sue Sharp, Cabin 28 represented a chance for a fresh start. The modest two-bedroom cabin was bigger than the trailer that they had left, and it offered a new life for her and the kids amid the pine trees and fresh mountain air. Sue was 36 and a devoted mother doing her best on limited means. She received about $250 a month from her ex-husband's Navy benefits and food stamps to feed her family. To make ends meet, she took a part-time job at the local Elks Lodge and enrolled in a federal education program to learn clerical skills, attending typing classes at nearby Feather Ridge College. Sue was quiet and kept to herself, pouring her energy into creating a stable home for her kids. Mike Gamberg, a former deputy who was familiar with the family, said, quote, "She was into her kids. She wasn't a drinker or a doper or anything like that," end quote. Living with Sue in Cabin 28 were her five children: John Sharp, 15, a tall, good-natured teen; Sheila, who was 14, who helped care for the younger ones; Tina, who was 12, a shy girl with big brown eyes; Rick, who was 10, and Greg, who was just 5. Though the cabin had only two small bedrooms, the Sharps made do. John, the eldest son, claimed a basement area as his bedroom, an unfinished utility space accessible only by an exterior door around the back of the cabin. The family usually left that door unlocked so that John could come and go and access the only bathroom, which was upstairs. Sue and her daughters, Sheila and Tina, shared one bedroom, while young Rick and Greg shared the other. Despite the tight quarters, the Sharp kids were well-liked and made friends quickly in the community. The neighboring Seabolt family in Cabin 27 became especially close. The children often played together, and teen Sheila was inseparable from the Seabolt girls, spending many nights at their house. In late 1980, another family moved into Cabin 26, directly across a narrow lane from the Sharps. Martin, or Marty, Smart, a 32-year-old Navy veteran, had come to Keddie to work as a cook at the lodge's restaurant. He arrived with his wife, Marilyn Smart, and her two sons from a previous marriage, 12-year-old Justin Eason, who would become friends with Rick and Greg, and younger Casey. Space in Cabin 26 was pretty cramped, so when Marty's longtime friend, Severin John, or Beau Boubade, showed up for an extended visit in early 1981, Beau had to crash on the Smart's couch. Keddie being so small, the Sharp and Smart families soon knew of each other. Sue and Marilyn Smart both attended the same typing class, where Marilyn sometimes confided in Sue about her unhappy marriage. By some accounts, Sue encouraged Marilyn to leave Marty due to his abusive behavior and his infidelity. Sue's eldest son, John, also had run-ins with Marty. The cook allegedly disliked John, perhaps resenting the teen's attitude or his closeness with Marilyn and Justin. So tensions may have been quietly brewing between the households, even as the kids continued to play together. Now, Saturday, April 11th of 1981, dawned like any other spring day in the Sierras, with no hint of the terror that it would ultimately bring. That morning, Sue and Sheila drove into Quincy, the nearest town, to pick up 10-year-old Rick from baseball tryouts at Gansner Field. On the way, they happened to spot Sue's oldest son, John Sharp, and his buddy, Dana Wingate, hitchhiking by the road. John and Dana had spent the night in Quincy with friends, and now the two lanky teens were thumbing for a ride home. Sue pulled over and squeezed the boys into her car, driving them 6 miles back up the canyon to Keddie. It was around lunchtime when they all arrived back at Cabin 28. John and Dana had plans to hang out with friends in Quincy again that evening, possibly at a party in town. After a quick lunch, the teens decided to head right back out. They wanted to clean up and change clothes first, so they hung around Cabin 28 for a couple hours. Around 3:30 p.m., John and Dana set out again, hitchhiking back toward Quincy down Highway 70. A local woman named Donna Williams later reported giving the boys a ride part of the way that afternoon, dropping them off near downtown Quincy. That evening, multiple witnesses saw John and Dana at a gathering in Quincy, and by all accounts, they were enjoying a typical Saturday night with their friends in town. Back in Keddie, the Sharp household settled in for a quiet night at home. Sue did not have a date or any plans to go out. As a single mom with young kids, her Saturday would be spent indoors. Next door, 14-year-old Sheila was excited for a sleepover at the Seabolt's cabin. She left Cabin 28 shortly after 8 p.m. to head next door, planning to spend the night with her friend Alyssa Seabolt. 12-year-old Tina Sharp was also at the Seabolt's that evening, watching TV. Around 9:30 p.m., Tina slipped back home to Cabin 28 to fulfill a quick chore. She had been told to put on her pajamas and finish up the dinner dishes before bed. After washing up, Tina returned to the Seabolts for a little while longer, but since Sheila was staying there and Tina was not, she eventually headed home for good. Tina walked back into Cabin 28 sometime around 9:30 p.m. and presumably went to sleep in the bedroom she shared with her mom and sister. Inside Cabin 28 that night were Sue and three children, her two youngest boys, Rick, who was 10, and Greg, who was 5, and their friend, Justin Smart, who was only 12. Justin had asked to stay over with the Sharp boys that night, and since the Smarts lived only a stone's throw away, Sue had agreed. The three little boys spent the evening in Rick and Greg's bedroom, likely watching TV or maybe playing games under Sue's gentle supervision. In fact, at 10 p.m., the two families' favorite TV show, The Love Boat, was on, and all three boys plus Sue watched it together in the boys' room before bedtime. By 10 p.m., according to Justin's later recollection, the household was quiet. The boys drifted off to sleep, and Sue presumably fell asleep reading or watching TV in the living room after a long day. Meanwhile, a curious outing was unfolding across the street at Cabin 26. Marty Smart was off work that night from his cooking job. He and his 27-year-old wife, Marilyn, and house guest, Beau, decided to have an adult's night out at the Keddie Lodge Bar, known back then as the Backdoor Bar. According to one account, the Smarts actually stopped by Cabin 28 briefly in the evening to invite Sue to come have a drink with them. Sue declined the offer. With her young boys and Justin in the house, she opted to stay in for the night. So around 9 or 10 p.m., Marty, Marilyn, and Beau headed to the Backdoor Bar on their own. Strangely, Beau and Marty were dressed to be noticed. Both men wore dark three-piece suits and sunglasses in the honky-tonk atmosphere of a rural mountain bar. Keddie locals later agreed that this was highly unusual attire for that bar, especially for two broke guys living in a cabin. Perhaps the men simply wanted to enjoy a Saturday night in style, or, as some investigators would later suspect, they wanted to be remembered by everyone who saw them that night as if they might be establishing an alibi. Marty Smart and his companions nursed their drinks at the bar for a while. Sometime before midnight, the mood soured when co-owner Jan Albin changed the music selection from country western to rock. Marty, who was a hot-tempered man, became irritated. He and Beau slammed down their drinks and left in a huff, with Marilyn in tow. Back at Cabin 26, Marilyn said she decided to go to bed, but Marty wasn't done stewing over the music. He later claimed that he phoned the bar from home to complain to the bartender about the playlist change. Then he and Beau returned to the bar for one last beer to essentially smooth things over with the staff. By Marty's account, the two men stayed at the bar until closing time, just before 2 a.m., then walked home to Cabin 26 and went to sleep. Marilyn corroborated that she didn't see or hear anything unusual after she went to bed. This would later become Marty Smart's official timeline, a story investigators came to doubt, suspecting much more may have happened in those dark early morning hours than Marty admitted. At some point late that night, John Sharp and Dana Wingate returned to Keddie from Quincy. For years, it was unclear exactly how and when they got back. Recently, a special investigator, Mike Gamberg, revealed that he located the woman who gave the teens a ride home that night. She told Gamberg that she dropped John and Dana off near the Sharps' cabin sometime between 10 and 11 p.m. The boys walked up to the front door of Cabin 28, illuminated only by a faint glow from inside, perhaps the TV light or a dim lamp in the living room. The driver said the scene gave her an eerie feeling, as if she could tell something wasn't right, just something was off in her gut, so she left immediately after the boys got out. John and Dana entered through the front door. Normally, if coming home late, John might have gone back around to slip into his basement room, but for whatever reason, this night, the two entered the main cabin where the family was sleeping. Unbeknownst to them, danger may have already been lurking inside. Sometime in the pre-dawn hours of April 12th, investigators believe roughly between 1 and 4 a.m., multiple assailants entered Cabin 28 and unleashed a frenzy of extreme violence. Neighbors would later report that around 1:15 to 1:30 a.m., they were startled awake by the sounds of muffled screaming. In one nearby cabin, a couple got up to investigate the strange cry in the night. When the screaming stopped abruptly and they didn't hear anything else, the neighbors decided it must have been an isolated disturbance and went back to bed. They had no way of knowing they likely had just heard the only cry for help that would escape Cabin 28 that night. After that single chilling scream, an awful silence fell over the Sharp home, and by dawn, three people inside were dead and one was missing. Plumas County Sheriff's Deputy Hank Clement was the first officer to respond to Cabin 28 that Sunday morning. Stepping through the front door, he was confronted with a scene of almost unspeakable brutality. The small living room was a display of blood and chaos, evidence of a prolonged struggle. The victims' bodies had been arranged side by side on the floor as if it were to display the carnage. Closest to the front door lay John Sharp, only 15, on his back. His hands were bound tightly at the wrists and with white medical tape. His palms were covered in blood. Next to John, face down and partially resting on a sofa pillow soaked in blood, was Dana Wingate, only 17. Dana's ankles were bound with an electrical extension cord, and that same cord snaked over to John's ankles, tying the two boys together even in death. Both John and Dana were shirtless. Their injuries were catastrophic. Investigators noted that John's throat had been slashed open, and his face and head were battered beyond recognition by what appeared to be hammer blows. Dana's head, too, had been savagely bashed, and a ligature mark on his neck made it clear that he had been manually strangled on top of his other injuries. The two friends had literally been beaten to a pulp, tied up, and left to bleed out on the floor. A few feet away, near the living room couch, lay the body of Sue Sharp, only 36. She was found half naked, wearing only a blood-soaked pink housecoat and nothing from the waist down. Sue's legs were splayed and her body had apparently been moved post-mortem. Someone had pulled her into a modest pose and covered her lower half with a blanket in an attempt at decency. It was later determined that this was Tina's missing yellow blanket, just tenderly draped over her mother's torso by an unknown hand. Sue's mouth was grotesquely gagged, her own blue underwear had been stuffed into her mouth, and a blue bandana was tied over them, secured in place by loops of the same medical tape that was binding her children. The tape was wrapped so tightly around her lower face that it bit into the flesh. Sue's wrists and ankles were also bound with tape and electrical cord, cinched so tight it cut her skin. Blood splatter analysis and Sue's own defensive wounds told the story of her desperate fight. She had raised her arms to fend off a blade, suffering deep slashes and defensive cuts as she fought for her life. She had been stabbed repeatedly in the chest, deep, penetrating knife wounds that punctured vital organs. Like her son, Sue's throat had also been viciously cut, near to the point of decapitation. Ultimately, the coroner concluded Sue likely died from massive head trauma. The killer had smashed the butt of a Daisy 880 BB rifle into the side of her head with such force that it left the imprint of the gun's muzzle on her skull. The repeated bludgeoning and stabbing of Sue Sharp was nothing less than overkill, indicative of explosive rage. The cabin's living room told a story of prolonged torture and mayhem. Blood was everywhere. It was sprayed on the walls, soaked into the green shag carpet, splattered across the ceiling and furniture. A chilling observation was the bottom of Sue's bare feet were caked in blood, as was the sole of one of the boys' shoes, suggesting that at some point during the frenzy, at least one victim was forced to move through the blood, possibly marched from room to room by the attackers. Investigators found bloody smears and drips in the bedrooms as well. On the door jambs of both the master bedroom and the boys' room, and even on the bedding in the girls' room where Sue and Tina slept, a trail of blood led out the kitchen and onto the steep back stairs of the cabin's rear exit, with a smear on the outdoor handrail as if something or someone had been dragged down those steps into the night. This crucial clue suggested the unimaginable. A fourth victim may have been removed from the scene. Amid the carnage, investigators recovered some of the murder weapons scattered in plain sight. On the living room floor lay a bloodied claw hammer and two knives. One was a common steak knife from the Sharps' kitchen. The other was a large butcher knife. The steak knife's blade was bent at a 30-degree angle, warped from the ferocity of the stabbings. A third weapon was conspicuously absent. Based on the head wounds, investigators believed a second hammer had been used, one which was not found at the scene. Decades later, this missing hammer would resurface under pretty startling circumstances, which I will get to. But in addition, small clues hinted the use of a BB gun or pellet rifle in the assault. The imprint on Sue's head matched the butt of a Daisy Powerline air rifle, and tiny plastic pellet fragments in a broken gun sight were found on the floor between the boys' bodies. It appeared the attackers might have even used a pellet gun to terrorize and wound the victims, firing BBs at them or pistol whipping them with the rifle before it broke apart. The level of overkill was staggering. Hammer blows, knife slashes, strangulation, and potentially a BB gun used as a weapon. Plumas County Patrol Commander Rod DeCrona recalled, quote, "They stabbed and pounded on everything in visible sight. The walls, the people, the furniture, everything. There was blood sprayed absolutely everywhere. You knew right away we were involved with a psychopath," end quote. Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com. Have you ever felt like no matter how much you rest, you're still just running on empty? Fatigue, brain fog, even brittle nails, those can all be signs of iron deficiency. And here's the thing, iron deficiency is way more common than people realize. It affects about 1 in 3 adults, especially women, and traditional iron supplements usually don't cut it. They're hard to absorb, and they often leave you dealing with nausea, constipation, or a metallic-y taste. That's why I recommend Citerol from Pharmanutra. Citerol is a premium iron supplement made with patented sucrosomial technology, which basically wraps the iron in a protective shield so your body can absorb it 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And the best part is it's gentle on the stomach. There's no nausea, no constipation, and no metallic taste. Citerol has been clinically studied, over 150 published studies, in fact, and it's trusted by more than 2 million people worldwide. It's Italy's number one supplement brand and is finally available here in the U.S. Just one capsule a day with water anytime, with or without food, and you're good to go. So if you're nodding along because you're exhausted, foggy, or just tired of feeling tired, this could be exactly what you've been missing. Head to pharmanutra-us.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Citerol. That's pharmanutra-us.com with the code MAMA, M-A-M-A, for 10% off today.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
Oddly, certain details suggested a deliberate staging or cleanup after the murders. All of the cabin's lights had been turned off and the drapes tightly drawn shut, as if the killers wanted to conceal the scene from any outside eyes until they were long gone. The living room telephone was found off the hook, its cord wrapped around a chair leg, possibly yanked out during the struggle or left that way intentionally to disable any calls for help. At least one of the victims, Sue, had been partially covered with a blanket, a gesture seen when a perpetrator feels remorse or personal shame related to the victim. And as noted, the victim's bodies appeared to have been posed or moved. Investigators found lone pools of blood on the floor and under that sofa pillow, which did not align where the bodies ultimately lay, indicating John and Dana's corpses had been shifted after they bled out. It was as if the killers wanted to arrange their gruesome handiwork in a certain way before departing. In the midst of this horrific scene, one person was missing, 12-year-old Tina Sharp. In the initial chaos, responding officers did not realize that they were dealing with a quadruple crime. The three bodies in the living room were assumed to account for all the family members that were present that night. Not until several hours later, perhaps when a sheriff's deputy asked Sheila to list everyone who should have been in the house, did it click that young Tina was nowhere to be found. A frantic search of the cabin confirmed that Tina's bed was empty except for a blood-soaked pillow and blood splatter on her side of the bedding. The child was simply gone. Investigators now faced not only a triple homicide, but also the possible abduction of a 12-year-old girl. The FBI was quickly called in under the presumption that Tina had likely been kidnapped by the killers and taken from the scene. Realizing Tina Sharp was missing sent a fresh chill through law enforcement and the community. Immediately, officers and volunteers organized a massive search across the area. They scoured woods, creek beds, and back roads around Keddie throughout that Sunday and into the following days, hoping against hope to find Tina alive. But the prevailing fear was dark. Given the horrific sexual nature of Sue's bindings and partial disrobing, could the motive have been sexual and Tina taken by a pedophilic perpetrator? With what had happened to her mother and now Tina herself missing, investigators feared the motive behind the killings and kidnapping was sexual. So authorities set up roadblocks on highways leading out of Plumas County and alerted neighboring jurisdictions. But there was no sign of Tina. It was as if she had vanished into the night. Inside the cabin, crime scene techs collected what evidence they could in 1981. Fingerprint dusting and blood typing were done. DNA testing was not yet available at that point, but dozens of pieces of physical evidence were bagged, and investigators took a series of eerie photographs of the blood-splattered rooms. Shockingly, some critical evidence would not be processed or even noticed for decades, clues that languished in storage only to be rediscovered by cold case investigators 30 years later. But in April of 1981, after days of intense but fruitless searching, Plumas County law enforcement had to face a grim reality. Tina was probably dead, taken by the same people who slaughtered her family. The Keddie murders case thus became a triple homicide and a missing child investigation wrapped into one. As weeks passed with no leads on Tina's whereabouts, the case grew colder, even as it cast an enduring shadow of fear over the community. For three long years after the Cabin 28 massacre, the fate of young Tina Sharp remained a painful mystery. Her surviving siblings and investigators held out a sliver of hope that maybe somehow Tina had been spared and taken alive, perhaps abducted and hidden by the killers. Then on April 22nd of 1984, 3 years and just 11 days after the murders, a man collecting bottles in a remote wooded area stumbled upon something unusual. He was scavenging near an isolated campsite known as Camp 18, about 50 miles southwest of Keddie in neighboring Butte County. In the brush off a desolate dirt road, the collector found what appeared to be a fragment of a human skull and part of a jawbone. Disturbed by the find, he contacted local authorities. Along with the bone pieces, searchers found a child's blanket, a blue nylon jacket, a pair of jeans with a missing back pocket, and an empty surgical tape dispenser in the vicinity. These items would later sound alarm bells for the Keddie case detectives. The remains were transported to forensic experts, and shortly thereafter, dental records confirmed the worst. The skull fragments belonged to 12-year-old Tina Sharp. The missing girl's bones had been lying out in the open for years, 60-odd miles away from her home. It appeared Tina's body had been dumped deep in the woods near Feather Falls, far away from any major road, a spot you'd likely only find if you knew exactly where to go. The discovery's timing raised some eyebrows. It was almost exactly the 3-year anniversary of the murders, leading some to wonder if it was pure coincidence or something more sinister. In fact, online researcher DMAC, who is the admin of the Keddie28 forum on Reddit, strongly suspects that this bottle collector finding Tina's remains by accident was a little too convenient. In one comment, he wrote, "Camp 18 is hard to find. Those roads are not labeled. As much work as I'd done, I still got lost twice trying to get there," doubting that a casual scavenger would venture so far off the beaten path. He and others theorized that someone with knowledge of the case wanted Tina's remains to be found at that time, perhaps to taunt law enforcement or bring closure on their own terms. Regardless of how the discovery truly came about, the Sharps family's worst fears were confirmed that Tina had been murdered and then discarded in the wilderness. In an astonishing oversight, a crucial clue related to Tina's case sat unnoticed in evidence for years. Shortly after the remains were reported in 1984, an anonymous 911 call was placed to the Butte County Sheriff's dispatch. In that recorded call, a male voice that was nervous and muffled told dispatchers, quote, "I was watching the news and saw the story about a skull found near Feather Falls. I was wondering if they thought of the murder up in Keddie in Plumas County a couple years ago where a 12-year-old girl went missing," end quote. In other words, the caller knew that the bones were Tina's before the police even announced it. This call was duly recorded and forwarded to Plumas County Sheriff's Office in 1984, but incredibly, it appears no one seriously investigated that tip at the time. The cassette tape was sealed in an evidence envelope and never listened to again for nearly 3 decades. Only in 2013 did cold case investigator Mike Gamberg discover the forgotten tape. To him and current Sheriff Greg Hagwood, this looked like a deliberate suppression of evidence, yet another sign that forces within law enforcement had dropped the ball, or worse, which we can touch more on those suspicions later. But the anonymous call strongly suggested that whoever killed Sue, John, and Dana also killed Tina, and that an accomplice or an informant knew exactly where her body was dumped all along. Despite renewed attention in 1984, the trail to Tina's killers ran cold again. With no DNA technology yet and only bones remaining, forensic analysis could not determine Tina's exact cause of death. A coroner's exam of the skull did indicate a sharp puncture consistent with stabbing or penetrating trauma, leading investigators to surmise that Tina was probably murdered the same way as her family. Perhaps she was stabbed in the throat like her mother and her brother. Whether she was killed in the cabin during the initial onslaught or taken alive and killed later that night still remains a point of conjecture. Some evidence, like Tina's blood in the bedroom and a neighbor hearing a scream, suggests that she may have been attacked inside the cabin very early on. Other investigators, like Mike Gamberg, think Tina might have woken up later during the ordeal, walked into the living room carrying her blanket, and was abducted alive only to be killed shortly after and then disposed of by car. Now, Mike Gamberg theorizes that Tina was hustled out the back kitchen door by one of the perpetrators and possibly kept in a vehicle near the cabin before being driven to the Feather Falls area later that night, or later that day or night. Now, one way or another, by the time sheriff's officers were swarming Cabin 28 on the morning of April 12th in 81, Tina Sharp was already dead or well beyond rescue. Her killers had a significant head start, and as it turns out, the benefit of critical evidence being mishandled. The discovery of Tina's remains in 1984 deepened the mystery and the heartache. The Sharps now had to mourn a fourth family member, and the community's horror was just rekindled. Plumas County's worst crime had officially claimed 4 victims, a mother, 2 sons, and a daughter, in an act of complete savagery that seemed to just defy explanation. From the outset, the investigation into the Keddie Cabin murders was plagued by confusion, jurisdictional issues, and questionable decisions. The brutal crime shocked the Rural Sheriff's Department, which had never handled a case of this magnitude. In the critical early hours and days, several significant missteps occurred that would later draw some harsh criticism and even allegations of a cover-up. So here are some examples of those things. First of all, Cabin 28 was never properly secured. Neighbors, staff, and deputies entered before the scene was ever controlled, which of course contaminated a lot of the evidence. Investigators also failed to process John Sharp's basement bedroom, where he and Dana may have been before the murders. No search was done for blood, footprints, or clues. The second thing was that there was this delay in even noticing that Tina was missing. Amid the chaos, responders didn't realize that Tina was gone for hours. Justin tried to tell the deputies, but he just was not heard. No roadblocks or alerts went out, and the back door, which was found open that morning, was overlooked. So by the time anyone searched for Tina, the killers were long gone. And then the third thing was that there were mishandled suspects. Attention focused early on neighbors Marty Smart and his friend Beau. And Marty admitted that he and Beau were out during the critical time frame, and Marilyn immediately left Marty after the murders, claiming that he was violent and hated John Sharp. But despite these red flags, both men passed polygraphs and were cleared. They left town within days, and then later Marty bragged about how he beat the test. Weeks later, Marty confessed to a VA therapist, saying that he killed Sue because she encouraged Marilyn to leave him, and that he killed Tina because she witnessed it. Well, the therapist reported the confession, but DOJ agents dismissed it as hearsay and took no action. And then there was all this overlooked evidence. So, for example, a note that Marty wrote to Marilyn saying that he had paid the price with four lives was never used as evidence, that he paid the price for her love with four lives. Never used that as evidence. And then there was these flawed composite sketches that were based on Justin's hypnosis session and then drawn by a friend of the sheriff. So not even a trained artist. And then there were lost or ignored items like a bloody jacket that disappeared, an audio tape about Tina that wasn't opened for decades, and then a hammer that was matching Marty's missing one sat in a pond until 2016. Additionally, when Plumas County turned the case over to DOJ agents who specialized in organized crime, not homicide, raised some eyebrows because Beau had Chicago Mafia ties. Well, investigators now believe that the case may have been steered away from Beau and Marty, either out of incompetence or protection. So Sheriff Thomas was also close friends with Marty, which, you know, added to concerns about bias, conflict of interest, and things like that. And the result was that key leads were dropped, suspects were able to walk away, and the case went cold. For decades, the community believed that the killers had been allowed to escape justice. The prime suspects, I mean, if you have even an ounce of common sense, would be Marty and Beau. Modern investigators are clear the strongest evidence still points to Marty and Beau as the prime suspects. Marty, being this violent Vietnam vet with a history of abuse, he had explosive anger and then, of course, very bizarre behavior. He was furious that Sue urged Marilyn to leave him. He mentioned a missing hammer right after the murders, and then they, of course, determined that there was a hammer missing from the crime scene. And then, of course, after the murders, he left Keddie almost immediately. His letter and confession were both highly incriminating, but nothing ever happened, and Marty died in year 2000. As for Beau, he was a 54-year-old ex-con with organized crime ties, like I've mentioned, but he arrived in Keddie shortly before the murders, stayed with Marty, and then was seen with him the night of the killings. Investigators believe that he helped restrain and attack the victims and possibly helped take Tina. He returned to Chicago soon after, and ultimately he died as well in 1988 before any charges were ever filed. Now, of course, there's a possibility of other people being involved. Marilyn may have known more than she admitted. Justin likely witnessed the murders, but was a traumatized child, not a participant. And investigators believe that maybe several locals helped after the fact, either disposing of evidence or staying silent because this was a small town. Well, their surviving Sharp children were ultimately raised by relatives. Sheila became the family's advocate for justice, and in the meantime, Keddie deteriorated, and eventually Cabin 28 was demolished in 2004. But the case did eventually reopen. Sheriff Greg Hagwood and investigator Mike Gamberg revived the case, uncovering major overlooked evidence, and they located that anonymous 1984 tape about Tina after her remains were found. They also were the ones who found the hammer. They processed fresh DNA from tape that was found at the scene and tracked down new witnesses. When the case was reopened, one of the most important pieces of old evidence was a strip of white medical tape that was found on the floor of Cabin 28 near Sue's body. The killers had used tape and bindings on the victims, and this piece had been boxed up and stored since 1981 without much attention after that. Well, when modern forensic testing was finally done on that tape, analysts were able to pull a usable DNA profile from the adhesive side of the tape, which means whoever handled that tape likely left skin cells or sweat on it, or, you know, transfer DNA, whatever it is. When that profile was compared against known individuals connected to the case, investigators got a hit, and the DNA matched a living suspect in their pool of suspects. They have not released this person's name publicly, but they have confirmed that it is not some random stranger. It is someone already tied to the case and considered a person of interest, and the match links that person physically inside Cabin 28 or directly to the bindings used on the victims. It doesn't automatically solve the case, but it does what this case never really had before. It connects at least one suspect to the crime scene with hard physical evidence instead of just rumors or letters and old statements. Investigators have said that this DNA match gave them some solid leads and that they know exactly where this person is today. They've hinted that with enough corroborating evidence, charges are still possible. So, in other words, this isn't just a historical curiosity. This is an active leverage in a still open homicide investigation. As of today, for Sheila and what's left of the Sharp family, justice is no longer about seeing Marty or Beau in a courtroom. Obviously, they are gone, but it is about the official record finally catching up to what they have believed all along, that the killers weren't ghosts or strangers. They were neighbors. They were known people, and the system, quite frankly, let them walk away. If the Keddie case ever does end with charges, a confession, or a conclusive public statement, it will be because people refused to accept, you know, that, you know, the police department blew it as the final word. It will be because decades later, someone took the time to open a dusty evidence box, listen to an old tape, test a strip of medical tape, and finally follow the leads that should have been chased from day one. Now, as for who that DNA source could possibly come from, nothing has been verified, so anything that I'm about to say is really just conjecture and my own assumptions, really, because, of course, I am very curious, as you might be too, on who this DNA could have come from, who is still living, and who could have had a tie to these murders, whether it was a tie to the family or a tie to the group itself. The most likely DNA contributors are people who were inside the cabin during or immediately after the murders. And that group is very small. It includes Marty, Beau, Justin, John, Dana, Sue, and Tina. Well, John, Dana, Sue, and Tina are dead, as are Marty and Beau, which leaves Justin as the most logical living match. However, he was only 12 years old when this crime occurred. I don't believe that if his DNA was found on the tape, that it means he had something to do with it, as much as I believe it just means that he was there at the time and it could have been transfer DNA or something to that effect. I do, however, wonder if it could be Marilyn's, because Marilyn, as we know, was with Marty and Beau that night. Marilyn was in a relationship with Marty. Their relationship was not good. He was violent. He was abusive. Could she have been threatened to, you know, help conceal these crimes by participating in some fashion, whether it was before or after the fact? I mean, these are just questions that we don't know, and we may not ever know. But I can tell you that Marilyn is still alive, so it could technically be her. It could also be Justin Smart, but no credible investigator or researcher thinks that Marilyn is the match. The consensus is still that the most likely DNA match is to Justin Smart, who, again, was 12 at the time. So I just don't know. And then, of course, the second most likely would be a still living accomplice who helped after the murders, and we can kind of surmise that maybe it's Marilyn. But again, this is unverified. This is just me kind of spitting thoughts that I have in my own head about it. What I can tell you is that this case obviously goes way back. There has been a lot of coverage and documentaries done on this case. And so I think that there are people with varying degree of understanding with this case who may have different theories. And if you know something that maybe I don't, or if I'm missing something you wish I would have covered in this story, I'd love to know it. You can let me know at mamamystery.com. You can scroll down. There's a box there where you can send me a message. I would love to know your thoughts on this case. And who you think is responsible. It does seem weird coming off the heels of the Dardenne family murders a couple weeks ago that was a Patreon exclusive. This story just has so many eerie similarities. So let me know what you think. And if you notice that my voice changed halfway through this episode, it is because I got sick over the weekend, and then I really just desperately wanted to get this finished so that I could get it out to you guys at a decent time. But that is why my voice now sounds so raspy. But anyway, with that said, I'll see you guys later this week for the weekly docket, where I recap the top headlines in true crime. If you have a story you'd like to recommend, you can let me know on Instagram, mama.mysterypodcast, or you can go to mamamystery.com to send me a message there. With that said, have a wonderful week. Stay vigilant. Stay curious always. Mama Mystery out.